Good afternoon, may it please the court. I'm Gary Kramer, registration 21167, on behalf of the appellant. This matter involves allegations of self-dealing in the administration of two trusts, the Clyde Foyles Trust and the Ruth Foyles Trust. There are four beneficiaries of the trusts, Larry Foyles, who is the son of Clyde Foyles and Ruth Foyles, and the three surviving grandchildren of the Foyles, Kyle and Kevin Foyles, who are the sons of Larry, and Gregory Foyles, who is the son of their deceased son, Gary. If it is acceptable to the court, because all the parties have the same last name, it may be easier for me from time to time to refer to the parties by their first names as opposed to just Mr. Foyles. Trust distribution provisions provide that upon termination, farm-related assets of the trust, both trusts, must be distributed to Larry Foyles, and non-farm assets of the trusts must be distributed to the grandchildren equally, with one caveat, and that is that the trusts both provide that Larry Foyles should be distributed 50% at least of the assets. So if there are if the farm assets are less than 50%, then the trustee must make an allocation of non-farm assets to Larry Foyles to bring him up to 50%. But otherwise, farm assets go to Larry Foyles, non-farm assets go to the three grandchildren.
And what was the approximate value at the time of distribution of those two groups? Were they approximately equal? Was it a little more than the farmland?
Your Honor, the trusts have not terminated, and so there has not been a distribution. What I can tell you is that at the time of the transaction at issue, which is the 2001 1031 exchange, Larry Foyles testified that he valued, he got the Emerson Street property, which was the apartment building, appraised at $510,000. That was the value at that time that he attributed both to the apartment building as well as to the Hudson Farm, which he contributed to the trusts. And I would like to review that transaction for the court, because that transaction is critical to our argument. In 2001, the trusts owned an apartment building in Denver. As a non-farm asset, that apartment building, which was income producing, would have been distributed upon trust termination to the grandchildren equally. In July 2001, the transaction, the 2001 1031 transaction occurred, whereby that apartment building was conveyed to Larry Foyles. So it was no longer an asset of the trust, and therefore no longer capable of being distributed upon trust termination to the grandchildren. In exchange, Larry Foyles conveyed to the trust a farm that he owned already in Morgan County called the Hudson Farm. So, upon termination of the trust, and that farm now is owned by the trust.
As I understand it, he didn't own the farm already. He had a contract to purchase the Hudson Farm. Is that correct?
The testimony was inconsistent on that. It was our understanding that he did own the farm, and it's my understanding from reading the record that his testimony was inconsistent. But in any case, that farm was conveyed to the trust by Larry Foyles, and now is owned by the trust. And it is that transaction that is the seminal transaction in this case that Gregory Foyles, my client, complained of, because as a result of that transaction, the trusts no longer own the apartment building, which, as I said, Larry Foyles had appraised at $500,000, $510,000 in 2001. And therefore, that significant asset, income-producing asset, is no longer available for distribution to the three grandchildren. Now, the trusts...
Wasn't the Emerson Street property considered to have been farm property for purposes of the trust because of a prior transaction?
Absolutely not. In fact, I asked Larry Foyles that question, and he testified that there was no agreement that that property would be considered farm property.
Yes, but he testified that he believed it would be considered farm property.
He said he believed it would be, but that there was no agreement by either Ruth Foyles or by the other trustee at the time that it would be deemed to be farm property.
But the apartment house was purchased with the funds from the sale of farmland.
That's correct. That's what the record reflects, that farmland was sold and that those funds were used at Larry Foyle's behest to purchase the Emerson Street property. The trust documents themselves, neither one of the trust documents provide that that property could be used, could be deemed to be farm property. In other words, there's no provision in the trust that says that if you sell farm property and use the proceeds to purchase non-farm property, that the non-farm property would be deemed to be farm property. There's just simply no provision in the trust. Okay, now, as I said, the trusts jointly owned the Emerson Street property. Ruth Foyles reserved to herself until her death the opportunity and the right to make decisions with respect to her trust. And she did. She was alive during this transaction in 2001. She died in 2004. And the record reflects that she did participate in this transaction. However, the Clyde Foyles Trust has a provision, Article 13, which requires that where a transaction takes place that benefits a trustee who is also a beneficiary, that the transaction must be carried out exclusively and solely by the corporate trustee. And Article 13 provides, quote, whenever the participation in the income or principal of a beneficiary who is also a trustee is being considered or may be affected by other action under consideration, all decisions shall be made exclusively and solely by such a corporate trustee. That's Article 13 of the Clyde Foyles Trust. That is, in our view, the seminal provision at issue in this case and in this appeal. If that provision is to be given effect, it must mean that the 1031 exchange at issue in this case could have been carried out solely and exclusively by the corporate trustee.
Could non-compliance with that provision have been rendered harmless as a result of the corporate trustee's subsequent ratification of the transaction?
That is what the district court held.
Did the district court actually use the terms harmless?
No. The district court did not use the term harmless that I recall. I would have to review the ruling. It's a 38-page ruling, as you know. I do not recall that the district court determined that it was harmless. But the district court did make a passing reference to ratification. What the district court said with respect to ratification is, on page 22 of its ruling and order, when the district court wrote, quote, the court further finds that there was no credible evidence presented at trial that any trustee of the Clyde Foyles Trust did any act that was not ratified by the co-trustees. That's what the district court.
Well, but Mr. Ullman, the vice president of the bank, said that the bank reviewed the Section 1031 exchange and consented to it. Couldn't the trial court rely on that evidence to decide that the trustee did in fact consent to the transaction?
Mr. Ullman testified that he refused to participate in the transaction.
Yes, but he also testified that he consented, that the bank consented to it.
Reluctantly, but he also testified, and this is critical for our argument, Your Honor, that Mr. Foyles presented him with the documents, and Mr. Foyles acknowledges that he presented Mr. Ullman with the documents, and Mr. Ullman refused to read them. He didn't want to participate in this transaction.
That's correct, but there was conflicting testimony from Mr. Ullman. One of the things that Mr. Ullman testified to was that the bank consented to the transaction. Wasn't the trial court, as the trier of fact, entitled to rely on that testimony to support its ruling?
We don't believe so, Your Honor, for two reasons. Number one, the language, the plain language of the trust documents, that this transaction must have been carried out exclusively and solely by the corporate trustee, we believe is plain on its face. And this transaction was not carried out exclusively and solely by the corporate trustee.
Well, the corporate trustee threatened to resign over this transaction, did he not? Or did it not?
In fact, Mr. Ullman testified that the corporate trustee's resignation was because of this transaction. It did subsequently resign, yes.
Let me run you back to a question Judge Terry asked. about the evidence of consent. Was there any indication when that consent was given? Was the consent given before the transaction occurred, after the transaction occurred?
The testimony was very unclear with respect to that. And I'm glad you asked that question.
And let me go back to my original question. Why can't either consent afterwards or ratification render harmless any noncompliance with the provision you're relying on?
If this court concludes that the language of the trust documents themselves, that is the exclusive and sole language that I quoted, does not make this transaction one that cannot be ratified. In other words, if the court agrees with me that that language means that the trustee had to have carried out this transaction and could not ratify it as a matter of interpretation of this language, the language of the trusts, then it could not be ratified. However, if the court finds that the corporate trustee could ratify and did ratify, then I suppose the court could also find, as the district court did, that that ratification would render this transaction harmless. We don't believe that that was the case. And in order to find ratification as a matter of law, in the Hauser versus Rose Healthcare System case, 857 P. 2nd at 529, this court wrote, in order to ratify a contract, the principal must have full knowledge of all the material facts of the transaction prior to ratification and also accept the benefits thereof. And in his brief to this court, at page 12, the appellee wrote, quote, Mr. Ullman, the corporate trustee, didn't understand the reverse 1031 exchange. Larry sent the documents to Mr. Ullman, but he told Larry he wasn't interested in understanding them. So the corporate trustee, by the appellee's own admission, did not understand these documents. Under the Hauser case, the corporate trustee could not, therefore, have ratified the 1031 exchange because it must have had full knowledge of the transaction in order to effect a ratification.
Ratification is normally an affirmative act. Not acquiescence wouldn't necessarily rise to a ratification. Even consent might not, arise to a ratification. Is that correct?
You just made my next argument for me, Your Honor. That is the position that we take. There, the district court did not make any specific findings of ratification, at least not so far as we could tell from the record. There was discussion about the corporate trustee accepting the assets and managing the assets after the transaction. What Mr. Ullman testified about that was that the corporate trustee saw itself as the manager of whatever assets there were. And as I said before, the corporate trustee also, Mr. Ullman testified that the corporate trustee resigned as a result of this transaction.
There's very little indication in the record, or at least the court's order, which sets forth details from the record, that trustee managed this farm, the Hudson Farm. It appears that, from what was said, that Larry Foyles ran that farm and invested money in that farm to improve the water rights and do other things with his own money. And there's no accounting, apparently, for the proceeds from that farm, if any, to the trustee. Is that a fair characterization of the record?
I do not take issue with that characterization of the record. That is what we believe the record reflects. Now, I only have a minute left. I was going to reserve time, but I want to just say, before my time is finished, that the relief here is very important. The district court clearly had difficulty wrapping its arms around the relief. The district court wrote in its ruling and order at page 31, Greg Foyles has asked the court to revisit and unravel several complex transactions that took place in 1996 and 2001. That is not what Greg Foyles asked for. It's not what Greg Foyles has asked for. Greg Foyles asked then and asks now simply for compensation as a result of the breach, which compensation may be effected by a surcharge. And that is what he asked for. In fact, my partner, Ellen Stewart, in closing argument, indicated that to the court, but for whatever reason, the court didn't buy it. And we contend that under Section 1516201, which gives the district court plenary authority over the administration and distribution of trust assets, the court had jurisdiction to grant that relief.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Lee Catherine Goldstein, bar number 31548 from the law firm of Fairfield and Woods, here today representing the appellee, Larry Foyles. And I want to reorient the court a little bit. I think based on the questions that the court has asked, I think that you've understood from the record that this particular 2001 transaction that the appellee has attempted to hone in on is really part of a series of transactions. In other words, he is complaining about the conversion of a what he calls a non-farm asset into a farm asset, but is not acknowledging that this is the second part of a prior transaction. And I think Judge Daly referred to this before. In 1996, a farm asset was taken and sold, and the proceeds from that farm asset were used to buy the Emerson Street apartments. At that time...
Was that the 1031 exchange in 1996?
That is correct, Your Honor. And at that time, it was understood, this is Larry's testimony, was that he understood, based on his conversations with Ruth and with the corporate trustee, Farmer State Bank, Mr. Ullman, that that Emerson Street apartment building would be treated as a farm asset under the trust. And he was encouraged to invest his own time and money into upgrading and renovating the Emerson Street apartments, and he did. The testimony showed that he invested somewhere in the neighborhood of $140,000 to $150,000 of his own assets into the Emerson Street apartments, with the understanding that if the trust terminated on that day, that apartment would go to him as farm property. And the trial judge found that was the understanding. That was in the trial judge's findings. So you can't just look at the 2001 transaction in isolation. You need to look at it as part of this bigger picture.
Did the bank's witness testify that this land was to be, the apartment house was going to be treated as farm property?
Your Honor, I don't recall the bank's witness testifying about it one way or another.
Okay, and the mother was dead?
The mother was dead.
So how did evidence of an understanding beyond your client come to be in evidence?
Larry Foyles testified to it without objection. So it was evidence in the record, and his subsequent course of action would have demonstrated that as well. So I think there were a lot of questions about ratification, and I do want to bring up one point about ratification, and that is the appellant is contending that there couldn't have been ratification because FSB's trust officer, Mr. Ullman, testified that he didn't understand the 1031 exchange transaction. There are two problems with that. I don't think that understanding the intricacies of a tax-related transaction and how that gets structured is the same thing as not knowing the material facts of the transaction. In fact, he was sent the closing documents. He certainly had the information, and the evidence was that there were two conversations between Larry and Mr. Ullman and one conversation between Ruth and Mr. Ullman about the transaction. So there really isn't any evidence that FSB did not understand the material facts of the transaction before it took place.
But in the father's will or trust instrument, the language is pretty specific about what the corporate trustee's involvement has to be for this transaction to occur. And it appears from your own comments that banks' actions and activities with respect to this transaction do not meet that.
Well, this was one of the problems that the trial judge was trying to grapple with. I mean, the corporate trustee in this case was basically very informal in its administration of the trust.
Appears that everyone was.
That may well be, but, you know, the corporate trustee, Mr. Ullman, had a law degree. He did trust work for his business. Larry and Ruth were farmers. So, you know, when you say nobody did, well, I think, you know, there's a little bit of a different expectation from a professional trustee.
Don't underestimate farmers.
No, I would not, Your Honor. But Mr. Larry Foyles did testify that he did not know. He did not have any formal education or training in how to be a trustee. And this was, you know, puzzling and troubling for the trial judge. He basically said during the closing arguments, you know, you want me to infer, you know, that the actions of the corporate trustee, you know, were to reject this transaction, but that's not what I'm seeing. And if the corporate trustee was to reject the transaction, he really did have the tools and the knowledge to be able to do that. He could have filed an action with the court objecting to the transaction. He could have done something to stop it from going forward, either before or after it occurred, to try to unwind it, and he did nothing.
What's the effect of not complying with the specific provisions of the trust, though? You know, because I think you would agree this was not a decision made exclusively and solely by the corporate trust.
Your Honor, I think you honed in on it earlier. It is harmless because the actions were ratified by both the corporate trustee, by their actions and inactions in the case, and also by Ruth. You know, Ruth was the settlor of her own trust, which owned half of this property, or part, I don't know if it was actually half of the percentage. And, you know, so when you look at, you know, the provisions of this trust, again, we're faced with the problem that the corporate trustee wasn't doing all of the things that one would expect a corporate trustee to do. And, you know, and the judge pointed this out as well.
Ruth was also managing her own trust.
That's correct.
Which was a party to the transaction. Is there any indication in the record that her involvement was other than managing her own trust?
I don't believe so. I know that at one point Larry had a power of attorney for her, but I believe that was close to her death in 2004. So I don't believe there was any evidence that back in 2001 she wasn't managing her own trust. And in fact, I don't...
Which would explain whatever participation she had in talking to the corporate trustee or anyone else.
Sure, but she was also a co-trustee on the Clyde Trust at that time.
Yes.
So, yes, I mean, she was obviously fully aware of and involved in this process and had either ratified it or actually affirmatively pushed for it, if we understand, you know, from Larry Foyle's testimony, that it was really at Ruth's bequest that this was happening, that the Emerson Street property was being sold and farm property was being purchased. And it was because Ruth had wanted to own farm property again.
Well, they owned a lot of farm property still.
That's correct, but she wanted her trust to own the farm property. I mean, it was always the intent, and the trial judge looked at this when he described the nature of these trusts. It was always the settlor's intent that Larry would inherit the farm property and all of the farm appurtenances, all of the equipment and things like that. And it was the settlor's intent that Larry would receive at least, if not more than, 50% of the proceeds of this trust. So, you know, what happened here was obviously in accord with the settlor's intent. So,
absent the first transaction, where farmland was sold and the Emerson Street property purchased, mm-hmm. would you be making the same arguments?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure because you have to look at the reasonableness of the transaction and the fairness of the transaction, and that the fact that previous farm property had been sold and converted into the Emerson property plays very strongly into that reasonableness and fairness analysis. So it's really, it's hard for me to say.
But under that argument, even if this transaction is faulty, because the prior transaction was the opposite way, for lack of a better term, it's harmless.
Because it was correcting the prior transaction. So
there's no indication the prior transaction was an error.
No, but the prior transaction was made with the understanding that Emerson Street property would be farm property. It would be treated as farm property. So it really did not change the character of the property in the minds of, you know, of two of the trustees.
And the Emerson Street property was adjacent to Larry's home, is that?
I don't.
Or some other property he owned. There was some allusion.
Yes.
It was across the fence from or adjacent to something he already owned.
I don't think it was his home, but I think it was a piece of income property that he had already owned. So yes, he was aware of the Emerson Street property. And there was one other thing I did want to mention factually. I think appellant's counsel had indicated that the value of the properties, the Hudson Farm property and the Emerson Farm and the Emerson apartment property, was about the same at the time of the transaction in 2001, and that's not what the evidence reflected. The evidence reflected that the Emerson Street apartments were approximately, I believe, $5,000, but the $500,000, but the Hudson Farm property was valued at closer to $800,000. It was $799,000, approximately, based on an appraisal that the court
found. What did he pay for it, or what was paid for it, you know?
Well, it was a 1031 exchange, so I don't know.
Oh, that's right. You wouldn't.
So I think, you know, at ground, the problem with the appellant's arguments in this case is that the trial judge weighed the evidence. He had disputed evidence in front of him. He weighed the evidence. He worked through the trust documents, and he made decisions that were based on the evidence in this case. The appellant's brief does not show that any of the rulings were devoid of any evidence or were abuse of discretion or were wrong legally. So because the appellant has failed to show any error and because the trial judge got it right in his 38-page decision, we respectfully request that the court affirm the trial judge's order in all respects.
Wait, I have a question. Why isn't subsequent approval beside the point? Why isn't subsequent approval of the transaction, of the 2001 transaction, beside the point? You didn't comply with the trust provisions. Looks like a breach of the trust.
Because, and I think that this is what played into the judge's thought process about why he had interpreted Greg's request as trying to unwind the transactions. You know, this attack, for lack of a better word, on this 2001 transaction is 5 years down the line from when this transaction took place. And during all that time, nobody contested it. The corporate trustee didn't contest it. Greg didn't contest it. It wasn't until 2005 when the trusts are being folded, you know, when a request has been made to the trial court to basically terminate the trusts and distribute all the assets, that suddenly there is some objection raised. And it's not raised by the corporate trustee. It's raised by Greg. So
and Greg, this transaction was reported to Greg at the time?
I don't know the answer to that from the record.
Is there any indication that Greg knew about the transaction in the record?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
Well, it wouldn't surprise you if he didn't object until he found out about it.
For some reason, I do think he knew. Of course, appellant's counsel is going to get up here in a second, and you can ask him that question as well. But I don't believe, you know, the corporate trustee was the one who was responsible for sending out accountings and all of those things to the beneficiaries, including Greg. You know, Larry was not the corporate trustee. He was not making those, you know, providing those notices. One thing that we do know from the record is that the corporate trustee did include the Hudson Farm property as an asset of the trust. So to the extent that Greg was getting information about the assets of the trust, he would have had that information as part of that disclosure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments and your briefing. We appreciate them. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.